Blog Talk Radio.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands. One nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Allahu Akbar, Allah.
With liberty and justice for all, hello Radio Jihadists, you're back with ACT Radio Jihad, your patriotic resistance movement. I'm Beto Esposito and thank you for joining us tonight. Today is December 7th, 2010. 69 years ago today, December 7th, 1941, a day that will live in infamy, the United States of America was attacked by Japan at Pearl Harbor, propelling the United States into World War II. Who could have ever imagined the United States could ever experience another horrific act of terror? But 50 years later, September 11, 2001, the United States was attacked again by an extreme ideology who again abhors our way of life, our liberties, and our individual freedoms. You know, December 8, 1941, the United States learned its lesson and fought back protecting our homeland and our U.S. Constitution. But sadly, 50 years after the attack on Pearl Harbor, the United States did not learn a thing. A totalitarian extreme ideology known as Islam is on our shores, they're in our neighborhoods, and have infiltrated our government, thereby threatening and undermining our way of life, our country, and most certainly our U.S. Constitution. A threat would not have been tolerated on December 8, 1941. You know, for 8 years following 9/11, America thwarted further attacks on our soil until November 4, 2009, when a major in the United States Army by the name of Nidal Hassan, a devout Muslim, went on a terror rampage at Fort Hood, Texas, killing 12 American soldiers, one police officer, and wounding 31 other soldiers. Nidal Hassan, a devout Muslim who attained the rank of major, did the unthinkable. 69 years ago today, America recognized who the enemy was. Today, thanks to political correctness and multiculturalism, we have let the enemy into the front door and gave them keys to the hen house. Ladies and gentlemen, Islam does not hold the same core American values because of Sharia law. Don't be fooled. With that, I'm joined by that no pork eating America lover, Alan Kay. Alan, how you doing today?
Doing great, Vito. Good to see you.
And Doc, we have Doc Miola on the line. Hey, Doc, how are you?
Fantastic. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you. December 7th, 1941. President Roosevelt say it's a day that will live in infamy, and it did for 69 years. Actually, it did for 50 years. You know, and today there hasn't been much fanfare about the attack on Pearl Harbor, has there? I haven't seen a lot today. I've seen that Dandy Don Meredith, formerly of the Dallas Cowboys, passed away. I just read, and Alan and I talked about that. What's her name? Edwards, Mrs. Edwards, passed away. John Edwards' wife, or estranged wife, passed away of cancer at 61. Both very sad. Both in the American limelight at some point in their lives. But something as extravagant, if that's a good word to use, as what happened on December 7th, 1941, should be the first news item every year. But I guess with Islam penetrating and on our shores now, something as horrific as Pearl Harbor really doesn't. People don't understand that historic event that occurred 69 years ago today. What do you think?
Well, I agree. I mean, you go to the Drudge Report, and the top story is Assange under arrest, the guy from WikiLeaks. He didn't wear a condom.
Ooh. Ooh. He didn't wear
no
a condom.
No bail. Yeah. Sabotaged condom during one night stand. Refused to wear one during another. Stockholm police, both women are victims. Interpol warrant for not wearing protection. That is the that's the lead story on Drudge Report.
Wow.
It's like Pearl Harbor never happened.
Yeah, and the let's see, but it's okay for him to buy classified information and release it on his website. I guess that's okay, huh?
Well, he did upset a lot of people, wouldn't you say, Doc?
Yeah, I'd say he did, but I support his right to do what he did. You know, they're claiming that it's going to cause some people some harm, but I don't see where they're getting that from, but I haven't read all the articles either. But I also do find it kind of amazing how he's saying, if you do come and arrest me, I'm going to release all these other articles. He was like kind of using that as a as a key card, I guess.
Blackmail, perhaps?
Yeah, that'd be a good word for it, you know. So they've been calling for it on Congress today. I was watching the live debates on the floor, and I can't remember the senator's name, but she's been calling for his arrest as a traitor. And from what I understand, though, he's not a American citizen, so you can't arrest him as a traitor if he's not, you know, can't be a traitor for a country he does not reside in, I guess, or is not a citizen of.
No, that was a buffoonish comment.
Who was that?
I said that was a buffoonish comment from our brilliant representative.
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, okay. But, absolutely nothing new on Pearl Harbor other than one little video clip that's on the Yahoo homepage. There's no other information about that. As a matter of fact, today's top trend of information for trending now, do the top 10 for what people are researching and Googling at the time. And number one is Noah's Ark. Well, we're in that kind of season. Miranda Lambert, Carrie Underwood, Cliff Lee, home health care, Elizabeth Edwards, which we did just mention, Jane Fonda, George Lucas, auto loans, and Marshall Islands. I don't see nothing there that says anything about Pearl Harbor.
Well, let's look back, Vito. Let's look back at Pearl Harbor. Over combat planes were also knocked out, and over 2,400 Americans were killed on our soil. Pearl Harbor was, up until 9/11, that was the greatest number of deaths of Americans on our soil. That's what made it such a seminal event.
Correct.
Nothing.
You know, it really took America by surprise. And, you know, whatever the conspiracy theorist is at, you know, right now, let's put that aside. But it took the vast amount of Americans by surprise. We didn't have the mediums available at our fingertips as we have today. And it's, you know, it really was a day that would live in infamy. But who would have thought that American would cover their eyes and you know, and 50 years later, we have September 11th attack.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of sad. I mean,
yeah.
You know, all five of my uncles, my father's brothers, all enlisted in the United States military in one branch or another between 1942 and 1943. How many Americans were killed in what's known as the greatest war of all times? And it was to protect and defend, you know, our way of life, so that today we weren't speaking German, or we weren't speaking Japanese. Well, we're speaking Spanish now. But, you know, and all joking aside, it was a time when there was a sense of patriotism that was felt, and a way to protect our land, protect our nation, and protect our United States Constitution.
Well,
that's just not here now.
No. Well, think about the history before Pearl Harbor. At that time, the American people were isolationists. They did not want to get involved with the conflict over in Europe. as Hitler was advancing and taking countries peacefully and by force, the people have wanted nothing to do with it. It was Pearl Harbor that changed that, because the Japanese, when they attacked us, that brought us into the war. Mm-hmm. Ironically, 9/11 did the same thing. The Islamists had been at war for us, but we were never at war with them. But when they hit the World Trade Center and killed 3,000 people, that was the wake-up call for the American people that we have an enemy. We have an enemy at our gates.
Correct.
So there is a similarity between the two events, and I'm surprised that that connecting the dots was never even brought up today with the mainstream press.
Yeah, and you know what? And they're so dissimilar in other ways. You know, and you look back in 1941, and I mentioned December 8th, because on December 8th, what happened? The United States put together a plan to protect and defend our country, and yes, it did propel us into World War II, without a doubt. I'm sure that's what it was designed to do, because we were sitting back as these events were going on within Europe and within Southeast Asia. You know, but look at what happened on September 12th of 2001. We were making excuses for a totalitarian ideology. We were taking and dividing the 19 Saudi and Egyptian Muslims who attacked the United States with the help of Osama bin Laden and Al Qaeda, and we were divorcing them from this religion called Islam, because up to then we were told Islam was peace. But at the same time, you look at what the Muslim Brotherhood had been doing inside the United States, laying the groundwork to infiltrate our colleges, our universities, our schools, our governments, our communities. And they were doing it in a stealth jihad way. And Osama bin Laden did it in an overt way. And on September 12th, we were making excuses. Our leaders, our United States political leaders, were making excuses for what was to be known today as the extreme portion of Islam, the extremists. No, they were devout Muslims. And there are plenty of devout Muslims living inside the United States. There are plenty of devout Muslims who are engaged in these acronym groups, these pure-sounding groups inside the United States that are headed by the Muslim Brotherhood. Council on American Islamic Relations, Muslim Student Association, Islamic Society of North America, North American Islamic Trust, Muslim Youth Association, all these, United Voices for America, all these pure-sounding acronyms, all these groups. No, they've infiltrated the United States of America, and on September 12th, our country has changed. We've succumbed to political correctness and multiculturalism, something that was not done on December 8th, 1941, because this country would not have stood for that. Hell, we're talking about and admonishing America for rounding up Japanese Americans and putting them in camps and holding them so that they wouldn't be perceived as being a threat to the United States. Heaven forbid, God forbid, we do anything like that today. Hell, just take a look at the imams of the 3,000 mosques throughout America. Take a look at the slumlord, Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, of the Cordoba Initiative in New York, how he's bamboozling America. Take a look at the video that you guys shot, Al. Imam, what's his name? Imam Muhammad Masri in Orlando, aiding and abetting the Palestinians and Hamas, raising money for Hamas in Orlando, Florida, mind you. And then, of course, here in Tampa, you got the professor who they're about to deport, who was this big time professor and member of the Council on American Islamic Relations and other organizations inside of the United States. So on September 12th, we learned nothing, not a thing. We're making excuses today for Muslims, because there's two different Muslims. There's the moderate Muslim and there's the extremists. And heaven forbid, Lord forbid, we cannot call them jihadists. We can't call them Islamists. I mean, can you imagine if these left-wing liberal wackos on December 8th, 1941 would have said, you know, we can't call the Japs Japs? That's offensive. They just attacked us. Oh, well, that's offensive. Can you imagine somebody standing up in Congress saying that? A left-wing, radical, fundamental wacko? It would have never – it never happened. They in Congress understood that it was time to protect and defend our country. And today we cannot protect and defend our country. We have open borders in Arizona, in Texas, New Mexico, and in California. They're so porous that it's causing utter chaos in some portions between Mexico and the United States. And now you have Islamists who are walking among us. They're living inside our government. They're dictating policy. You have the two individuals, Shura and Ali Khan, from Los Angeles, two devout Muslims who are making policies inside of Homeland Security. What a disgrace that is. Oh, but, hey, we're diversity. We have to be diverse. This is a multicultural society. Where we hear that? Diverse. Multicultural. Kumbaya. Go ahead. I can go on and on.
Well, a lot of it, I mean, you ask some good questions. Why? Why is our government not waking up to this Islamist issue? And a lot of it has to do with Dennis Ross. He's an American diplomat and author. He served as the director of policy planning in the State Department under President Bush, the special Middle East coordinator under President Clinton, and he's currently special advisor for the Persian Gulf and Southwest Asia, which includes Iran, to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Well, at one point, Dennis Ross, Imam Faisal Roof, Daisy Khan, Dalia Mogahed, Dalia Mogahed, the executive director of Gallup Polls, they all formed together this group called the U.S. Muslim Engagement Project. So they are the leaders of the foreign policy, of U.S. foreign policy, and their whole U.S. Muslim project was intended for Obama, you know, and throughout the document it goes, for our next president. And they believe, to shrink the base of support for extremism, our strategy calls on U.S. governmental and private leaders and their Muslim counterparts to work together to advance four goals: resolving conflicts through diplomacy, improving governance in Muslim countries, promoting broad-based economic development in Muslim countries and regions, and building mutual respect and understanding. Sounds all good, but they're all unattainable, in my opinion. You want to go through them one by one?
Yeah, Al, read the first one again. Oh,
okay.
My God.
Oh, my Goddy.
Oh, my Goddy.
Yep. Resolving conflicts through diplomacy.
Okay, so solving conflicts through diplomacy?
Yep. Resolving,
right?
Conflicts.
Resolving conflicts.
Yep, through diplomacy.
Okay, so we're going to resolve conflicts through diplomacy. Let's see. Let's go back 200 years. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, we've been fighting Islam for 200 years. George Washington and John Adams, both presidents of the United States, were paying the Muslim pirates, the Barbary pirates, a ransom, a jizya, an extortion, jizya, there's that word again, J-I-Z-Y-A-H, so that the Muslim Barbary pirates would not attack our trading ships in the Mediterranean Sea. Thomas Jefferson, you know, everybody hails all the Muslims like to throw Thomas Jefferson out as this president who understood Islam. Well, he did. What did he do? He created the United States Marines and put them on a ship, and they escorted our trading ships in the Mediterranean Sea to fight against the Muslims who we tried to negotiate to resolve a conflict. And guess what? The Muslims wouldn't negotiate. So what did President Jefferson do? He fought them, and he won. And we stopped paying the extortion fee by Muslims in 1802, 1803. Okay, that's one. Would that be resolving a conflict through negotiation?
Well, no. No, that was by force. So negotiations didn't work because they tried to deal with these Muslim Barbary pirates because we didn't have a navy then. They just said, hey, lay off of our ships, our commerce ships. And the Muslim Barbary pirates said, no, they're in our waters. We have the right to hijack them, as Muhammad did, the caravans in Mecca and Medina. So they did.
All right. So let's see. How about the conflict in Afghanistan? Let's see. How is that going? Resolve conflicts through negotiation.
Well, not so good. In fact, our government is talking with the Taliban. Remember the stories from the last few weeks on the show where the Taliban, Iran was sending
money?
Bags of money
to
the Taliban. We were sending bags of money to the Taliban. And Pakistan and Ahmad Karzai were sending bags of money to the Taliban.
Yeah, and Ahmad Karzai was also getting a little skim off. He was getting his vig from that, Al.
Right. So that's diplomacy. They were trying diplomacy, but it was trying to pay off the devil.
Mama mia, no Sharia.
So that didn't work out so good.
All right, how about the diplomacy or negotiation in Iraq? How did that work for us?
Well, let's see. You've got Al-Qaeda in Iraq, who's still there. Basically, it was a Sunni country, for all intents and purposes, run by Saddam Hussein. So we took out Saddam Hussein. They hung him. There's a big power vacuum. So who's filling that now? Iran.
Oh, Iran again.
Iran again. Because Iran is Shia. So now the Shia have been trying to get rid of the Sunnis in Iraq for 100 years. So we helped them do it. So now they're filling the vacuum. And now Iran is filling that vacuum in Iraq. And the Sunnis are now the minority. The Christians are being killed. Things are not better. They're not adopting any democracy of any kind because they're an Islamic state.
All right. So now if we want to resolve conflicts through negotiations, the best example has to be the Israel-Palestinian conflict, and that has been resolved through negotiations, hasn't it?
I wouldn't say it's been solved. There's a lot of dead bodies piled up.
I'm reading that the Dennis Ross resolved conflicts through negotiation. So obviously that has been resolved, right? No?
I don't know, Doc. Has it been resolved?
Not that I'm aware of. The only thing any kind of negotiation does at all for anyone is to buy the enemy, our enemy specifically, time to better equip themselves in case of battle. It's nothing more than a stall tactic used by our enemies because they know that America will try to negotiate, even though they want really nothing to do with it.
Right. And then you take the Sunnis and the Shias, Vito. Heck, they can't even live amongst each other without killing each other. You don't read a story a week about Sunnis killing Shias. Shias blowing up Sunni mosques, killing Qurans, burning them up. You hear about that all the time. And this is Muslim on Muslim violence. And the only difference with these two, that the Sunni and the Shia, is that because Muhammad and his infinite wisdom from Allah didn't have a clear line of succession when he died. The Shia believe that one other person should have been the leader. The Sunnis believe that another branch of Muhammad's family should be the leader. So now the two of them fight and kill each other because they think that they're more Muslim than the other. So if they're killing each other over something like that, then where do we fall into the scale of humans?
Yeah, the pecking order.
The pecking order. We're like the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah, exactly.
So why would they even want to have diplomacy with us when they're killing each other, the Sunnis and the Shia? Why would they even consider us as a diplomatic partner? A real diplomatic partner. I mean, you can sit down at the table with anybody because we're the richest, strongest country in the world, and they have to. But, I mean, a real diplomatic partner? Hell no.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point, Al. You know, what we have seen, we see the newspaper every day. We see the reports coming out of Iraq. Now that our military men and women are being withdrawn from there, there's still all these bombings where 50 people were killed in a market, 120 were killed. And you know what people fail to realize is exactly what you just said. It's Sunni on Shia violence. It's Shia on Sunni violence. They can't even resolve their own negotiations, own conflicts through negotiations.
Not hell. They blow up their own mosques, each other's mosques. And if one of our soldiers so much as touches a mosque, it's a national event because we are so impure that we can't even go into a mosque, much less bomb a mosque where there's militants in it, yet they do it to themselves. It's a horrible double standard. And how do you have diplomacy, real diplomacy? I mean, it'd be nice to have, obviously, and it's a nice pipe dream, but it's totally an unrealistic goal.
Yeah, exactly. How many military men have lost their rank, have been forced to retire, have been admonished, have been court-martialed as a result of what the Shia have done to the Sunni, what the Sunni have done to the Shia, and all our guys are doing is they're trying to protect themselves and their men in this conflict.
Right.
Because we can't call it a war anymore because, you know, Obama has changed that, and Janet Napolitano once called a man caused disasters.
Mm-hmm.
She is a female lesbian disaster is what she is.
Right. Now, their next one, improving governance in Muslim countries.
Oh, there you go. Hey,
okay.
All
right. That's our goal, is to improve governance in Muslim countries. That means in itself that their governance needs improving. Well, how do you improve upon an Islamic state? Well, you make it more democratic. That's what I hear. Now, do you think the Islamists are going to be very, very happy with us coming in and trying to change their Sharia law to make it more democratic?
No. They don't recognize. There's no recognition of man-made law. That's the other. The other thing that makes us a little bit naive, so to speak. There is no governance in Sharia law when it comes to man-made law. They do not believe in man-made law.
Right. That's simply understanding your adversary. They believe that divine law given to Allah through the angel Gabriel to Muhammad supersedes all man-made law, all biblical texts, from the Torah to the Bible to our Constitution and Bill of Rights, which is man-made law. All that is secondary and superseded by the Sharia law and the Quran. So how do we improve governance in Muslim countries without them hating us even more? Because you look at Dr. Zudi Jasser, he's the Muslim reformer here in America, and Tafiq Hamid, and he's trying to do just that. He's trying to reform the Sharia law to take all the bad stuff out of it. And he's got death threats. He's considered a blasphemer and an apostate to Islam. His fellow Muslims want him dead. So that's
reformist.
Yeah. So that noble goal is not going to work so good. The third one, promoting broad-based economic development in Muslim countries and regions. Okay.
Well, what's that even mean?
Well, I don't know.
Go ahead. You take that one.
Promoting broad-based economic development in Muslim countries and regions. Okay.
Oh,
well,
minute. That was Sheikh Obama's primary goal. You know, we have the men and women, business men in the United States who are struggling. We've gone through an economic downturn. And what does Sheikh Obama do on April 27th and 28th of 2010? He conducts a Muslim entrepreneurial summit. So that's what that means. It doesn't matter about American businessmen. He wants to promote capitalism inside a totalitarian ideology that doesn't recognize man-made law. It's totally diametrically opposed to Allah's law.
Right. So what we're asking, assuming that we can achieve this goal of all this very good intention goal, that would mean that the Muslims would have to backtrack. They would have to backtrack from their Islam and their Sharia law and their Sharia finance. And that's not going to happen.
Correct. So
that's
so. Is
work.
Our government that inept? Is that are our leaders that inept, or is that a wishful thinking issue?
Were they that arrogant, Vito? Are these liberals who are with this U.S. Muslim Engagement Project? Are they so arrogant that they believe that everybody wants to be like us?
Is it arrogance or is it ignorance? Or is it a combination of both?
I think
it's almost.
Go ahead. I'd say it's arrogance because the very
really?
Last one is building mutual respect and understanding. Well, if you've done the first three, these guys are already upset because you're trying to take away their Sharia law. You're trying to impose capitalism, and you're basically telling them that their Sharia law or divine law isn't all that great, and they need to take a look at a little capitalism and a little man-made law to improve themselves. I don't think Yeah.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I don't think the Muslims are going to take the first three very seriously. In fact, it's going to make them angry and want to kill us even more. So that's what I think.
Well, see, that's what makes me think it's ignorance on the part of Americans who wrote this document or wants to follow this particular ideology. It's ignorance to think that if they're thinking under a Christian mindset, that Christian mindset does not play well in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, and therefore it's incompetence on the part of our political leaders who haven't done their homework, who are misguided in their thought process and are hanging the United States out to dry with this particular ideology. And that sadly means, in my mind, that our brave men and women who are fighting in the military are giving their life to incompetence, to people who don't understand who the enemy is. And it goes back to December 8th, 1941. Our military leaders in America knew who the enemy was. Our politicians knew who the enemy was. The President of the United States, for all his faults, knew who the enemy was. And today, going back to George W. Bush, to Bill Clinton, to George H.W. Bush, they didn't know who the enemy was. They still don't. They're not admitting who the enemy is. Even with all the information that we have today, the FBI taps, the Muslim Brotherhood memo, the co-founder of CARE's comments about Islam is not in America to be equal but to become dominant. With all this information, they still, Dennis Ross puts together this inept summary that we're going to change the heart and mind of Islamists? Are you kidding me?
Well, Lerner and
that's ignorance.
Well, Lerner in the chat room brings up a great point. She wonders about the article about Afghan women that blames their plight on tribalism. Now, tribalism is a very, very interesting point that's been left out of the equation. So I hope she calls in and brings up that article. because tribalism is probably one of the things that separates us Americans, because we are family, community, government.
And it's the same tribalism that is being invited to the table to bring Afghanistan under control. What? It's the same mentality that believes that there are devout Muslims who follow the Quran, the Hadith, and the Sunnah to the T. It's the same tribalism that stones women who are accused of adultery, kills apostates and homosexuals, and yet it's the same tribal leaders that engage in the Baba Barishka boys. So, I guess.
Well, the Baka Barish boys are a funny
Thank
story.
Thank you, Baka.
The tribal leaders in Afghanistan, so as a way for them to show that they are rich and powerful, is they have boy dancers that they dress up in women's clothing, and they have a homosexual male, young male stable, and that's how they elevate their status within the Afghanistan community. And this is from tribal leaders to warlords. So they have all their little boy toys. It's extremely gay, one. And in Islam, homosexuality is punished by death, yet it's a dual system where I guess they don't consider that gay, but they have young boys dressing up as women dancing around. I think it's really gay.
You're a homophobe, I guess.
Well, I mean,
if you're part of the Taliban, you'd be a homophobe.
Yeah, they wouldn't. I wouldn't fit in. I'd have to hang up my turban.
Yeah. Give me your camera. You give me your turban.
You're fired. You shave your beard. You give me your turban, and you go somewhere else. You leave this town, or we kill you.
We kill you. I kill you. Give me your camera. I kill you. Oh, my God. So these same tribal leaders are the ones that are being invited back to the table in order to bring Afghan under control. And these are the people that are also given the money, these tons of money, suitcases full of money from Iran, America, Pakistan, in order to be nice to these people. So that fits that negotiation to resolve a conflict through negotiation, right? Oh, my money and the Sharia. Oh.
Yeah.
You see, that's why, Al, that's why I believe it's more ignorance than it is arrogance. Yes, it's arrogant to think that you can change and you can inflict your way of life on this totalitarian caveman ideology. But it's ignorance not to know who your enemy is. And if we are fighting a war on terror, at least we were during the Bush years, then why is it that the Bush people didn't understand who the enemy was? And you can't suck up to these people on September the 12th, 2001, and think that these people are going to be your friends. Because the slumlords, Imam Faisal Abdul Raufs of the world, are going to exploit your ineptness, your ignorance, and push forth their agenda.
Let's see. Caller 304, you're on.
It's me. It's Lerner.
Hey, Lerner, fill us in on this female tribalism issue.
How are you? Well, first let me say I believe the speaker is right. I can't tell your voices apart. I mean, I can't put them to names, I'm afraid.
Oh, this is Alan.
That's Vito.
Okay.
Vito's
Vito.
Right.
And well, Doc is back there somewhere.
You know, I think that part of American culture has always been that we concentrate on what people share. And so it's like we can absorb all kinds of immigrants because we all share these same values, you know, and then we extend it internationally. Like, we can get along with the Russians because we all love babies. You know, we can get along with whatever group because we all take care of our old people. You know, the idea of a mindset that is different, really fundamentally different, the way that Islam, or at least these Islamic leaders are, is just something Americans don't understand. And I think you're absolutely right. The people who are doing the negotiations for us and stuff are being driven by this kind of naive approach that, you know, all you have to do is be friendly and sincere, and that will cut through all that culture stuff, and we'll get down to these basic values, like liking babies. And they're being driven by President Obama's mandate to reach out to Muslims. You know, like NASA is supposed to make Islam feel good about its mathematical history or something. You know, and people, no rational person would take that on as a project unless they were ordered to do it by a higher up. So that was my first point was I honestly agree with you. I think that we seem to have a naive blindness about the character of nations and the character of cultures, which is getting us in trouble now that we have to deal with more and more of them.
Correct.
My second, I wanted to call in, and this is related to tribalism. In the December 2010 National Geographic, they have this article called Veiled Rebellion. Afghan women suffer under constraints of tribalism, poverty, and war, and now they are starting to fight for a just life. And nowhere in this article do they mention Islam. So, you know, nowhere. And so there's two women in full-length sky blue burqas in the first page. Then there's a picture of women in a group, and some are hiding their face in various ways with a burqa or with their hand or with a paper fan. Or, you know, and then the next page is some poor little girl who was married off to some guy. And so she burned herself to death to try to die. Well, she didn't die, unfortunately. So there she is, poor burn victim. And then we move on to, then the guy's trying to make it look like these women have an effective rebellion, you know, that they make these little poems that are nasty about men. Then the next picture we have, in Herat, the shrine to Shirazda, Qasim, blah, 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 is more than 1,000 years old. One day each week, a section is partitioned so women can come to worship. Cordoned off to create a sanctuary for women, these prayer sections seem to me some of the safest, most intimate places in the country. And he says that they're enveloped in chadors that cover them from head to foot, even though they're all together with other women. And some of them are weeping uncontrollably. I always wonder, why are they crying? Perhaps because of the deeply emotional nature of public prayer and the holiness of the place. Yeah, well, maybe because they live miserable, oppressed lives. And then the next picture is of a woman whose husband cut off her nose. Her husband beat her, so she thought she might die, so she went to her neighbors for help, and to punish her for relieving that permission, he cut off her nose, ears, and her hair. And here's a picture of a young girl, about 20, with no nose, just holes. And then you turn the next page, someone's getting married, that's a pretty picture. Then the next page, some woman is driving a car, and you can see some man looking at her murderously because you can see her hair, and she's actually driving the car by herself. Then we have Afghan women who are learning to be part of the Summer Olympic Games in London in boxing. Then we have police women shooting at targets. And then here's a sad picture of this woman. She was jailed because... She was married off, she was 12, and she was married to a man who was 70 and who was paralyzed. And she goes, I was so young I couldn't carry him because he was so heavy, so his brothers beat me. When I asked for a divorce 4 years ago, she was in prison. And she goes, I am in jail now because I don't have a male guardian. I can't get a divorce, and I can't leave without a male guardian. Now, how can you say all this, that nothing about this has to do with Islam? How can this? How can National Geographic be so... And there are more pictures of, like, you know, women getting veils and, I mean, women getting degrees and women dressing up. And here's little girls, they dress up. They say the little girls put on makeup and spend hours at the hair salon, and young girls are able to show off their makeovers. But once a girl arrives at puberty, she masks herself from men with a burqa or hijab. It's like, how dare National Geographic not mention the religion that these horrible events take place under?
I think Gomer Pyle said it best. Surprise, surprise, surprise.
I really just, you know, and they blame it on tribalism. They blame it on, you know, domestic violence. They don't talk about a religion that allows you to beat your wife, tells you how to do it.
All four of them.
Yes, all four of them. And so that was my second point, was I just wanted to bring up this article and how awful it is that National Geographic would distort would distort the reality of this.
Well, a lot of that, Lerner, I think you tell me if I'm right, it's liberals will not be judgmental. They will not say that something is good or bad because there's a moral relevance in everything these days.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be a part of the problem. Whereas here on Radio Jihad, you included, and Doc, and all the listeners who are regular listeners, y'all are judgmental. You can look at the facts and go, hey, this is right or this is wrong.
Well, there's certainly nothing wrong with looking at a culture that oppresses women and saying, this oppresses women and that's bad.
Right.
You know, they make it sound like, oh, if we could only deal with the tribalism, if we could only deal with the child marriages, if we could only deal with the slave-like status of women who are married into abusive marriages, you know, if only we could deal with these things. Isn't it exciting that Afghani women are writing snarky poems about men in places that men will never see and having their own little sanctuary, which to sob uncontrollably in the mosque while covered from head to foot? Like, I fail to see these. And a few are getting diplomas, and a few are learning to fire guns because they have to have Muslim police women because the men can't do some of the things that the women do. I fail to see this as very exciting step forwards, and I feel so sorry for these women.
But that's an epidemic that the United States is guilty of. The epidemic is the lack of investigative journalism, the lack of investigation on the part of our military leaders and our political leaders. This lack of investigative, we'll put it all in one umbrella, investigative journalism is what the United States is succumbing to when it comes to articles like this or describing the totalitarianism of Islam, the oppressiveness of Islam.
Well, you know, the journalists used to pride themselves on getting the truth no matter what it costs them personally. And now it seems like they don't want to really look critically at things. You know, I was once at an interview, and this has nothing to do with Islam, but the man they were interviewing said something that wasn't true. And I said to another reporter, that just isn't true. Are you going to investigate that? And she goes, no, we just report what he said. And I said, well, you know, you're not a reporter, you're a repeater.
How did they respond?
Well, she was just going, I don't know.
Well, that's a problem with our journalism, for sure.
Yeah. It's like, that's a new thought.
Well, a lot of it,
like
too,
that.
Is that I bet you if they had done this story, because it's a story on women, and if they had gone to the root of the matter into how Sharia law treats women, that I'll bet you $50 that story would have been spiked.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think maybe that's it, that they wanted to. They felt that they were getting the information out there that Afghani women have an oppressed status, but they were doing it in such a way that they wouldn't get backlash from Islamic groups. So maybe they thought they were pretty clever.
Yeah.
But I think they were pretty cowardly and misleading.
Now, as a woman, where's the National Organization of Women? When they read stories like this and see the abuse of women in Islamic countries, why are they silent?
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Why do you think?
I don't know. I used to be a member of NOW, and after many years I left because I realized it was no longer reaching out to women who truly were puzzled by the conditions of their life. You know, women, is it okay that he beats me? You know, is it okay? Now, women who were just kind of beginning to look at the conditions of their life and now had become very political and they just wanted to elect people. Now, this was a couple of decades ago. But I also left because I realized that if a woman was found standing over a dead man and in her hand was a smoking gun and in his head was a smoking hole, somehow it was his fault. And I thought, you know, I don't want to trade the prejudice that limited my life for a new set of prejudices that are going to be put on other people. You know, I don't dislike men. I don't hate men. And I don't want to always turn the world upside down in order to somehow make the woman in the right. I'd rather be treated like a person, like an individual, and treat others that way. So where they are now, I don't know. I haven't been in touch with the group for a long time. I can't understand how they cannot I suppose because it's a religious matter, or because so many Muslim women say, well, I like wearing hijab. You know, I like being under a burqa. And the problem is, like, if you go to a prison and you talk to people and they go, well, I like being in prison, you know, can you believe them or can't you? Because after all, when you leave, the people who want them to say that they like being in prison are going to be there alone with them. So when a woman says, well, I love wearing my burqa because nobody can stare at me, does she really mean that? Does she really have any experience of what it's like to not wear her burqa? Or is she just saying that because she's been told? Or is she saying it because her father or husband will get very angry with her if she says something differently? So, I don't know.
You know what I think?
What?
Because I've talked to the Noni Darwishes and the Wafa Sultans who are former Muslims, and they are women. And that same question that you had always perplexed me. Because I was like, okay, well, you see these women, if they had the chance to remove that burqa and live free, wouldn't they be happier? Isn't that really what they want? Is there being, I think that they're being abused. But as it turns out, with about 80% of these women, that they're not willing to give up their Islam and Sharia law, because that is how they're taught that things are, and their love for Allah will not allow them to change because they don't think that anything is wrong. Now, the other side of that coin, too, is that if they do, let's say that they are a reformer and they want out, that if they do that, they're going to lose everything. They will likely be killed. They will lose their family. They will lose their children. They will lose their husband. They will lose their community. And in that environment, if you do not have your family, community, the tribalism, you're as good as dead. It's not like in America where you can just go to a different state, start a new identity, and start over. You don't have that luxury. It's a life or death issue for you to leave Islam.
And I also think many, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And I think many women, my thought went right out of my head. I mean, I think you're right. I think many women cannot imagine a world other than the one they live in. So they see the few rights and protections that they have under Sharia law as being very precious. You know, and maybe they're married to someone they don't know or something, so they value being able to get away from men, you know, to be away from the men. So what they're doing is looking, I mean, anybody can find an advantage in almost any condition. So they have, you know, found advantages and not really being able to understand how they might live differently. But, yeah, I would prefer Sharia law to chaos. Maybe that's the best way to put it.
Let's bring it home. The Rivka Berry case. Have you heard of that?
Remind me.
Okay,
remind
Rivka
me,
Berry.
I know the
was,
name, but.
Yep, she was a young girl. She came from Sri Lanka. Her parents came here illegally, which later found out in court, and they brought their family here to, and they moved to Ohio, and they were raised in Ohio for many years, and then all of a sudden, Rivka Berry decided she wanted to become a Christian. And Vito can explain how her life went into total turmoil.
Well, at 14 years old, she accepted Jesus Christ into her life. And then at 17, she was befriended by a pastor in Orlando, and she actually fled her home in Columbus, Ohio, and came down to Orlando. The pastor met her and picked her up at a bus station, and he had then called the authorities after a couple of days to make sure she was all right because her life was threatened. She was leaving Islam, and, you know, leaving Islam is not the right thing to do, and you will be killed. You'll be killed by your brother or your father or by some family member. Hence, you know, fast forward a year later, she turns 18, she has her freedom. She ended up being valedictorian of her class in Ohio. She did have to go back to Ohio, but she was in the custody of Department of Children and Families, and her parents did not know where she lived. So it was a success story. She did not have to return to Sri Lanka to face her maker, and her maker would have been death from leaving Islam.
So does her family know where she is now? She had to essentially start over.
They do not know where she is.
Yeah, And she's in Florida. She has no contact with her family. And when she ran, the family was going to take her back to Sri Lanka. And if she had gone back there, it would have been a death sentence, and she literally ran from there. Now, this is all happening in America.
Right.
Well, so then she, in effect, the result of her decision to leave Islam for Christianity or any other faith resulted in her, and she's a minor, resulted in her leaving, her family disowned her and wanted to kill her. Her brothers and sisters disowned her. She had nothing. She had no family, no anything. She gave up everything, and all she did was change her faith. And nearly cost her her life in America. Can you imagine these women in Afghanistan? They don't have any place to go.
That's true. They have no place to go. I think tribalism is difficult for us to understand, too, because we're loyal to our family, but we don't feel that our family is the social face of all of us. You know, tribalism is more like if one person's an arm and one's a leg, and, you know, it's all a part of one body, and the action of one reflects on all the people in that body, and then they have the responsibility to cut out or punish whatever has shamed them in public. We don't really think of family that way. We can have family loyalty, but if there's a black sheep in the family, you know, shunning them is enough, or just, well, that's the way they are, you know, that doesn't reflect on me in the sense that I have to do something dramatic and physical and violent to make it clear that I don't approve of what that person does. And that's another place where we fail to see the difference. Because we're Americans and we're always going out with this, if you're open and you're honest and you cut to the basics, and it comes down to stuff like, we all like babies. You know, yeah, we all do like babies. Yeah, we all do enjoy the sunshine. But unfortunately, from there, we start building very different cultures with different values. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you do when that's brought here to America? You take Amina and Sarah Saeed. These are two Muslim girls. Same thing, they became westernized. Mm-hmm. Their father shot him dead in a cab, and they had it all on 911, on a 911.
I was going to bring that up, yes. You know, what do you do? I don't know. I mean, maybe some Muslim people come here and they don't realize that we are a different culture, that, you know, it's not, we are a different culture. And people who come here with values that they don't want their children to assimilate, maybe they should consider why they're coming here. Because that was just horrible. And I think, yes, he's still free, isn't he? He's like somewhere no one knows.
Well, he actually took an escape route through Mexico, and now they believe he's in Egypt.
So this was all set up so he could do this?
Well, that's
hasn't
been proven, but it's pretty circumstantial, because after he whacked his daughters, then he immediately went to Mexico and then went reverse migration and had contacts in Mexico. They got him through Mexico and then onto a plane into Egypt. So this is premeditated and thought out. And that was because the girls, they lost face.
Mm-hmm. Well, look at the poor woman who started Everybody Draw Muhammad Day. You know, she's now in the Witness Protection Program.
Yeah. Nothing ever happened.
Yeah, who's going to be brave enough to do that this year, you know? Who's going to be brave enough to have Let's Draw Muhammad Day when you're going to end up having to put all your life behind you? Pretty scary stuff.
Yeah, and that was all on the internet.
That's right. That's right.
Or Facebook.
I'm wondering if they're hunting down everybody who drew Muhammad that day. So we shall see. I just wanted to call up and make that comment and talk about the National Geographic article, because I feel like that's just such a misleading thing for them to have done. And just an example of how, you know, they'll blame it on everything else, like it just sprang out of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And like there isn't a system. And I've seen an imam on YouTube, and he says, well, if you want to cut your girl's genitals to give her dignity and bring honor to her future husband, then go ahead and do it. If you don't want to, you don't have to. Like, Islam takes no position on this action. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how can there be a religion that doesn't take a position on that?
Well, actually, they do. Sharia law has that all covered. Now, here I'm going to throw something at you, where Sharia law is going here in America. is that this is what, following the template that happened in Europe, is that the imams, probably in a like Dearborn, Michigan, that has a very, very large Muslim population, mm-hmm. they're going to come in and they're going to go, well, we need family Sharia courts because our culture is unique and we need to deal with certain issues within our culture. So we need these family courts, family Sharia courts, and they won't be a threat to your federal courts. If somebody commits a capital crime, of course they'll go to your federal courts. But we need these courts here for our community. How would you process that?
Well, I think we talked about that before.
Yeah.
That the Jewish courts are, they're set up so that they don't trump U.S. law. I would be very nervous about that because we don't need competing legal, equal competing, you know, legal systems where American law isn't overarching. Now,
right.
Talking about genital mutilation, I have heard arguments that it should be done in hospitals here
mm-hmm.
in America because it would be cleaner and more sanitary.
Right. And
which
doing
is,
it in Europe.
That just gives you the chills.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, you know, parents want to mutilate their children rather than make it very difficult and very, very bad punishment for them doing it. We'll help them out by doing it in a clean, you know, in a clean environment.
Right. Who are we to say that their culture is wrong?
Well,
I am.
I am. Yes, I think I could take a pretty clear stand on that.
I know Doc. He's pretty outspoken.
I mean,
when
you're depriving a child of her future sexual pleasure, then how could you be right? You know, it's just there should be no hesitation to take a stand against this.
All right. Well, since we last talked about that subject, because
mm-hmm.
that was probably a couple of months ago, the Oklahoma case where the citizens of Oklahoma, they had a referendum on the during the last midterm elections to ban Sharia law in Oklahoma.
That's
70%
right.
of the people voted in favor of this ban, along with international law, that no international law or Sharia law by name will supersede federal, state, or local laws. Fair enough. Article 6 of the Constitution says exactly that, that our laws will rule. Period.
Right.
But the judge said no. She's holding it up in court and saying that she's holding up the people's will in court because she disagrees with it. And you have the Council on American Islamic Relations who filed a lawsuit stating that this law, according to Munir Awad, violated the religious freedoms of Muslims. And
in
no
way
does it. But that,
yeah, in what way?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
There isn't no way, but it's being held up. And this is now CARE is on the side of Sharia law at odds against our legal system.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going on now. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, it's scary stuff. You know, we have people who – we have judges who are willing to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, they want to be able to – I don't know. I mean, I don't know how – anybody could think that religious law can be the equivalent of, I mean, how could it be wrong to say we don't want a certain group's law to be more important than the law of the land? I don't understand where the judge is coming from, and I don't know what's happening in this country. It's like many people are foolishly divesting us of our culture and our values in pursuit of something that just isn't going to work, which is a land that has no culture. It just that's when we're going to have civil war, when we just have no overarching culture and we only have territories occupied by one stronger group or another. And that's very possible. These people act as if there's something given and eternal about the America's values, as if it isn't something that needs to be maintained or needs to be cherished and taught. And I don't understand how they can be so naive. Maybe it's because they've never had any stress in their life or something, that they think, oh, no matter what I say or do, no matter how I undermine my own country's culture, it will always be there because it always has been. I mean, I don't get it. I really don't.
I hate to cut in, but I have to go, and I just want to say God bless America, God bless our troops, and Lerner, thank you, and everybody else in the chat room, thank you as well for listening. So good night, folks. I have to leave.
I'm afraid I have to go, too. I didn't want to dominate your show.
So. Oh, no. Why don't you hang on? Because we're going to go into this with this. I think it's all based multiculturalism, political correctness, misguided notions of tolerance, and frankly, the sheer willful blindness have combined to create an atmosphere of confusion and denial in America about the current threat confronting the nation. A particular concern is the fact that the political and military leaders in the United States find it difficult and or distasteful to explain the true nature of the enemy to the public and even to discuss it among themselves. Presented with detailed factual briefings and voluminous information about the essential linkage between Sharia law and violent acts of terrorism, and they most simply refuse to speak candidly about that connection.
Well, I got a comment, but backing up, actually, not so much to what you read. Thought it popped into my head when Lerner was talking earlier about the genital removal or the whatever the word is that they're using for it.
Female genital mutilation.
Okay, thank you. And where they want to do it in the hospitals and making it easier. I wonder where the outcry is, because this is a minor we're speaking
right.
about.
Okay, mm-hmm.
And you have constantly see it. I watch the C-SPAN, so I see a lot of what's happening on the floor all the time. And every so many months they bring this up, whether it's the abortion issue or protecting the rights of children. Well, here in America, we have so many organizations. Every state has their own code for that particular child and family services type of code that they use and refer to. They should all be all over this. This should not be taking place. There should be – they'll come in as me as an American citizen and a non-Muslim. Okay, there's a rumor that I'm abusing my child. They're knocking at my door, taking my kids away, all right? And I got to prove that they were wrong. You know, you're guilty till proven innocent when it comes to the children. Well, how come they ain't acting against these Muslims? This is a minor child. They're doing a voluntary medical procedure, okay? They should be going in, knocking down these doors, because they can get a warrant signed, or they have even what's known as an open warrant in a case of a child, where it's already signed by the judge. They just need to fill in the date and the address, okay, to enact the warrant. They should be banging down these Muslims' doors and taking these children away. Put them into child and family services. They
You're
do it
right.
to everybody else.
You're right.
You know,
I
and
mean,
that just really what popped into my head when you were talking. I'm like, where are these legal organizations, not voluntary groups like the NOW group or whatnot. These are legal, state-run organizations about children's rights. And they're silent. And that's really, to me, is, okay, that means the state is, and that organization and the state is in compliance with this, in my mindset.
Well, it's, you know, it says if, in order to have respect for other cultures, we have decided that we can't have any critique of them. So, you know, maybe at one time America really did think that a little too much, that our culture was the very best and that everywhere we went and introduced it, good things happened. So maybe we need to back off from that, from thinking, you know, maybe everybody really should live an American life. But what's happened is an almost reverse, where it's like American culture has no particular value, and none of us have any right to criticize anything about other places. So, you know, it's almost like, well, you know, the Nazis are doing this and that, but that's Nazi culture, or, you know, this other religion is cutting up their girl children, but that's, you know, they like to do that. That's their tradition. And why... I suppose there is a line where we might say, I mean, there is a line somewhere where it's just like, well, you know, I don't like your French pastries. Okay, well, that's really not my business what the French do with their bread, but that's a very, you know, that is very far away from saying I don't like you cutting up your children. And but we're acting like we have no authorization to speak out against anything because it's all relative. And it's all, you know, it's all our own prejudice. My prejudice is that one should not mutilate children. And that's my prejudice because I come from that kind of culture. And if I, you know, other people feel you should mutilate children and their opinion needs to be considered too. And it's like my prejudice, you know, my prejudice is that women should be able to walk around in the sunlight and have the wind blow in their hair. Well, you know, I think I do have a right to say something about those things.
I think, like, I agree with you 100%, and I think if they were going to do it anyway, they would take them out of the country to have it done, and that's fine. We can't fight what they do in another country, but as long as you're here in America, you got to play by our rules, and they don't, and that's the real issue. Mm-hmm. But I had another thought earlier, and I'm just going to throw it out there because I have not researched this, and I usually don't like bringing up things I haven't at least touched on somewhat, but I had a flashback. When Alan Arvito was speaking earlier, they were talking about, and you as well, with the tribalism and how different things are laid out and how they do the things they do.
I hope that's a sound effect and not something happening in the studio.
That's your Vietnam flashback?
Yep, absolutely. It sure is. But what I was thinking of was China. Now, China is supposedly one of the eldest cultures out there, one of the oldest languages out there. Well, although we don't speak about it or hear about it, the women are second-class citizens. A husband can behead their wife. You know, so it seems like a lot of things, if you put them side by side, are very similar in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the women have to walk two steps behind the man. That, you know, she can't speak unless the man gives them permission. You know, if the father of the household tells the kid, hey, I just went number two in a toilet and you go grab a fork and eat it, you better eat it or he's going to kill you. And
that
comes from China.
Is that true in modern China?
Yes, it is. Actually, it's just not practice anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like everything else. It's a law that's on the book that's never been removed.
Oh, okay.
Okay, mm-hmm. So in other words, it's part of their culture. They do not have to act upon it.
Mm-hmm.
Mind you, okay? But at the same token, if they were to act upon it, it would not be frowned upon or frowned against. In other words, okay, you know, he's a Orthodox, I guess, would be a word for it. But like I said, I haven't really researched that deeply into it. But it just seems to be like the culture and the way that they treat their women.
Mm-hmm.
And they also do arranged marriages. And, you know, there's an awful lot of similarities. Then I'm kind of asking, well, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Which came first, China or Islam?
Well,
because the cultures seem to go pretty hand in hand.
I don't know. I would have to know a lot more, too, to really to be able to compare them. For some reason, women do end up with second-class status. And maybe it's because women are more vulnerable when they're pregnant or women are women with children are more they're more apt to adjust to bad situations in order to protect the children. Or maybe it's because, you know, they say there's this theory that it used to be that people didn't really know how babies were made, because, you know, it's 9 months later that the baby comes out, so there's no direct cause. You can't really draw a line from the event one day and the event 9 months later. But once they did figure it out, then they began to see women as being somewhat like cattle, you know, that they were there to produce children for the men. And then once you care about whether the babies are yours or not, then you have to start restricting women and watching what they do and making sure they aren't dropping other men's babies into your nest. And I think, doesn't Islam say that because men are superior to women, and because men spend their money on women, women have to obey men and, you know, be true to them and stuff like that. And so, I don't know, a lot of that's just deep in the history of humanity, and I don't know why. But there's another quote, which is that you can judge a culture by how it treats its women, that's the litmus test.
Well, that's true. I can tell you, Lerner, that there was an event here in Orlando where a Muslim group over at UCF put on a Women in Islam group, and there were some women who were there who came over from Saudi Arabia. And she said exactly that when that topic came up. She said that the men make the money, and it's and they have to share it with the women. So the women actually have power over the men because the men have to give the money to them. And she said the exact quote that you had just said.
Mm-hmm.
And I was floored because here she is in America, and she doesn't think that she is a second-class citizen at all. In fact, she takes pride in it, in that belief.
Well, you know, does Islam define how much money the man has to give the woman? I mean, this woman's pretty privileged if she's busy flying around, appearing in public and stuff.
Yeah,
so
well,
her
she's
husband,
in America.
Yeah, I mean, her husband must have a lot of money to give to her. I'll tell you, women in America who are running around wearing burqas, like I was just reading about some woman in... You know, 911 tested her face, so she decided, yeah, I really do want to be Muslim, so she started wearing a burqa, and she's running around in her little cage. And I thought, you know what, you're just playing at what is really going on for many, many women in the world. Now, you choose to wear your burqa, and you walk down the street. If you chose not to, nothing would happen to you. Whereas for many women, they have to have that cloth. That's their only protection, is to cover themselves up and show that they will conform to what's demanded of them. And it kind of makes me sick to see women in a free culture prancing around pretending that they're extra, they're just extra extraordinary because they can choose to wear their chains. And it's pretty rude of me to say that, but I don't care. You know, right now it's just, to me, it's like, no, they don't understand that like you said earlier, a lot of women have no choice. They have no place to go. If they want to live on the streets and beg, then they can rebel against the system. And so, of course, they look for the parts of the system that make their life livable, and they celebrate those parts, and they play them up. You know, so, yeah, he has to give me some money, or, yes, you know, but I wear beautiful clothes when the family's all together, or whatever it is. It's just very, it's a very tough question, and I don't, I wouldn't even know what to make of her statement. I'd have to know a lot more about Saudi culture, because who knows if it's really the way that, if we can take it the way that she describes it. Like, I was looking at photographs of some women in a demonstration, and someone was saying, boy, look at all those women out demonstrating together. They really have the guts. They're the ones who go out and demonstrate. And I thought, well, you know what? There are only women in that crowd because women and men cannot mingle. So, of course, there's only women. Most of the time, there's only men. And secondly, maybe they can go out and do this demonstration that the men and their family back because nobody really cares what women do. So they're maybe less likely to be punished as long as they're doing what the men and their family want them to do. So even looking at a photograph, we can misinterpret it.
Mm.
Do you agree?
Well, you take Sharia, and even though it has spiritual elements, it would be a mistake to think of Sharia as a religious code in the Western sense,
mm-hmm.
because it seeks to regulate all manner of behavior in the secular sphere, economic, social, military, legal, and political. So it's all-encompassing. Now, when you put in all the elements of social, military, legal, and political, conforming and wearing the clothing of that society, it takes on a whole different meaning. Whereas
right.
here, our individuality is prized.
Right. And so wearing a burqa in America is a show of individuality. That's what I'm saying. It's a show.
Yeah, you nailed it. It's kind of weird. It's reverse individuality.
Yeah.
Whereas they want to be different.
Yeah,
they
it's
want
like,
to
look,
be...
look at me. Look at me. I'm conforming to the dictates of this religion. It's like, well, what do you mean, look at me? I was reading this thing online, and this woman was saying, you know, I'm a Muslim woman, and my husband was sick, And so I made him some soup, and some people might think that's demeaning, but I will be rewarded by Allah. And then I made him some lemonade, and some people may think that's demeaning, but Allah will reward me. And then I did something else, I don't know what, made up his bed or something. And Allah will reward me for that too, you know, because maybe it's all very subservient and self-effacing, but I'm going to get this reward. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. Your husband was sick, so you made him some food and made up his bed. And you say you're doing it for selfless reasons, but you're expecting this big reward from Allah. I don't understand what's selfless about it if you're doing it in order to get this reward. So the whole thing is very complicated.
Yeah, it's a form of heroism. It's like, do I do it because I want the recognition and the reward and the trophy and all this, or do I do it because it's the right thing to do as a human being?
Right. Like, to me, it didn't seem that all that extraordinary or subordinate that she would make her husband soup. You know, that didn't seem like an extraordinary measure of anything, really, except normal human kindness. But this was on a Muslim website, and it was trying to explain the Muslim woman's life and how you should feel and how you should think. So,
well,
yeah.
That kind of goes back to where Islam is economic, social, military, legal, political, religious, social, and that everything is for Allah. Everything you do is for Allah. Now, if you can remove yourself and put yourself into that little box to where the world revolves around Allah, He controls everything from the minute you wake up to the minute you go to sleep to the minute to how you pray to how you bathe to how you defecate, to how you cook your food, how you do everything, how you raise your children, you run your business. I could go on and on, but you get the point.
Right. So by eradicating your individuality and conforming to the rules of this system, you achieve, that's what God wants.
Right. And the more that you conform, the more that you will be rewarded by Allah as being a good Muslim, and that's where your worth is. That's where you get your worth.
And what is the reward for women after death?
Well, the men, it's supposedly 72 virgins.
Does everybody get 72 virgins or just the heroes?
Well, that depends, because not everybody's going to go to paradise.
Oh.
There's the hierarchy of people who go to paradise, and it's a very, very small percentage.
Well, do any women go to paradise?
They say that they do.
Do they get 72 virgins?
What, do they get 72 male virgins?
Yes. What would they do with 72 women?
Well, from what I understand is that the women, when they get to paradise, that they become beautiful and that they become the shaheeds, or the men that are there.
Mm-hmm.
They become beautiful to them, and they become the wives of the shaheeds, and for them that is a great honor. So it's almost a double standard even in paradise for the women.
Yeah. So they marry the heroes, but the heroes also have 72 virgins.
Yeah, it's like the men got it pretty good.
Yeah, I can definitely see which side of the dividing screen I want to be on. So, well, thank you for answering my questions. And
well,
I enjoy your show very much.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, this is, I take that back. This site says that when Muslim men die and pass to Islamic paradise, they expect to enter a utopian dimension where wine, milk, and honey flows. They're greeted by 72 young virgins. But there's no virgins for women in the Muslim paradise, according to Ted Sampley in the U.S. Veteran Dispatch. Muslim women were and still are restricted to the role of wife, who is a source of comfort for her husband and mother for his children. This is because Muhammad was heard to say, men are the protectors and maintainers of women, because Allah has given one more strength than the other, and because they support them from their means to stay quietly in your houses and make not a dazzling display of yourselves like that of the former times of ignorance.
So basically, paradise for women is just more of the same.
Apparently.
Well, I wonder, I wonder if we would realize that. So.
Well, that's what I could never understand, why a woman suicide bomber would strap bombs onto herself to blow herself up.
Well, part of that is because they recruit women who have been accused of rape. And so these women have no future anyway. And they tell them, if you blow yourself up, you will expiate your sin. You know, whether or not they've actually, I mean, who's guilty of rape? I mean, what victim is guilty of rape? You know what I mean? But that's what they do, is they will, that's one thing they do, is recruit women who are already marginalized by society. You know, they're in desperate straits and they have no future. And so they tell them, if you kill yourself for Allah, then you will be forgiven. And that's one way they recruit. Isn't that sad?
Well, it's criminal, because they know that it's not true. Society has made these women basically throwaway objects that they're using for their own that they're using for their own military means.
That's right. I mean, taking people who, first of all, if you're a rape victim, why would you be in any trouble? I mean, a victim is a victim. And secondly, it's so easy to accuse women of rape, of having been raped or having adultery. And so, yeah, it's just going to the people who have nothing and saying, now that you have nothing, maybe this will look attractive to you.
Mm-hmm.
You can have everything if you put these bombs on you and blow yourself up.
I'm sure
they get a few fanatics who can hardly wait to do it, but that's one means by which they recruit women for that.
Yep, and here's also where they tell that, because paradise, Islamic paradise, is described largely in male terms, which we've already established, the exact nature of an equivalent reward for women remains unclear. Married women who pass the purity test will be reunited with their husbands and children. A woman who married more than once would have to choose which husband she would prefer to join her in the afterlife. She, however, remains reserved for her husbands if one chooses to keep her.
Oh, brother. Well, okay. That's a real paradise. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's been interesting. I'm going to hang up and listen. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Thank you very much, and great call.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
All right, now here's a quote from Dr. Parvin Darabi. She's a rehabilitated Muslim woman, author, and activist. She said, quote, "I am a Muslim woman. I have no face. I have no identity. Islam believes and promotes only one relationship between male and female, and that is the relation of lust. I have no explanation on why Allah denied me everything and made men in charge of me. If there is a God, I don't believe there ever was one." That's a pretty powerful quote, wouldn't you say, Doc?
Absolutely. And at least we have, in our general Christian society, you know, marriage is only until death. You know, until death do us part, then you're free to marry again.
Right.
And that's what popped into my head when you brought that up before about, okay, well, they're in paradise, they're still stuck married, so they can't even get away from this in death.
Yeah, what if they don't love their husband? And then
right, they don't have a choice. There's no choice in that fact.
I tell you, Islam is definitely a man's world. And I tell you, I hate to admit it, but there is a compelling nature from a guy's point of view, because when I was learning all about Islam, I'd been to the mosque probably over 30 times. And when you're up in the front row praying and all the women are behind you, there's a certain power structure that's going on within the mosque, and the men are elevated, the women are behind you. It's almost like a men's club. There was a part of me and a part of me that liked it. Is that wrong?
No, that just means you're a human being. I mean, it's a natural stroke to the ego. I mean, that's why, in my opinion, why China is still that way.
Yeah.
China, even without, is very traditional, where the women will always be, you know, a step behind the man, and, you know, not speak out of turn, and always spoke when spoken to, and that's very traditional for the women of China, and it allows their men to flex their muscles, as it were, to feel their seniority, their control over the household. You know, it's allowing the male to maintain his head of household, where here in America, we don't have that. You know, it's very rare that you will find a woman who uplifts their spouse to any kind of degree.
I pledge allegiance.
Well, Doc, we've got about 30 seconds left. I'd like to thank you very much for being on the show today. Learner, great call, as always. Vito, excellent job. So God bless America. God bless our troops. America Akbar.
America and Israel Akbar to you, my friend.
Oh, that's it. I missed the I missed the closing with the woman laughing. Oh well.
Yeah, that's what I was waiting for. I was like, it didn't trigger. I thought you had it on auto or something.
I'm looking for it and I couldn't find it.
Oh well, all good. Yeah, I don't know why I got on that whole China thing tonight. When you were talking earlier, and I'm listening through and I'm running through this through my head, because I used to study the old culture years and years ago, all the way back into Egyptian time. And if you look at all the societies, all the way back to Egyptology, and you can compare so much of it to Islam. The difference is Islam has brought out the physical violence aspect of the whole culture. They dirtied the culture of the old. You know, I look up to the old culture. You know, the respect, the families that, you know, they stayed together. You know, we don't have that in America. We got our independence. We got our freedom after World War II. The women came out of the household, went into the workplace because the men were off working.
Right.
And they never got back into the house. They stayed out in the workplace. And that's where America's downfall was. You know, if the women and family stayed together as a unit, if the man was the one to be lifted up and allowed to go out there and be a proper head of household, and we brought our children up to learn their roles as other cultures have done, that's a very powerful thing. That's a really strong unity. But with the destruction of the family and the, with the old saying, you know, women's right. Women found out when they stood up for their rights, they lost their seat. Yeah,
boy, some women would say that you're a misogynist.
That's okay. You know, I'm happy with that. I mean, I'm happily married 15 years. My wife was a stay-at-home mom, raised my three children until I got hurt. And then she took up the sword and, boom, she went right out to work, and I've been retired ever since.
Yeah.
And I'm at home now doing the, you know, Mr. Mom thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but until then, you know, it's always been one parent working, the other one at home raising the family. And we've done it together and made that conscious decision before marriage that that's what we wanted to do.
That's good for
you
the kids.
You live on a tighter budget, and you have to adjust for that, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a much better, it's a more stable environment for my children. It's a much better relationship that I have with my wife. My wife is my best friend. You know, when we may argue amongst ourselves, you know, that's common. You're going to argue, you know. But whenever I hear somebody on the outside that she may be on the phone, and I can just tell by the way the flow of the conversation is that person may have said something negative towards me because I'm no longer working, that my wife right away jumps right in there. You don't understand the situation, you know, and is right away jumps to my defense. And that is what's missing in America today, the family structure.
You know where I think that went? I think that the culprit is our tax code. Is that before taxes skyrocketed like they did, one earner could raise a family, pay the mortgage, and put the kids through college. But now with the tax code, it takes two people to work in order to pay the taxes and to make ends meet, whereas before it didn't used to be that way.
Well, I can cut that down. I agree with you, but I disagree with you.
Okay.
And I'll
Why do you
explain
disagree?
That. Yeah, I'll explain that. The reason I disagree Okay, I pay taxes. My house isn't paid for yet. I still pay mortgage. I still pay taxes. I'm living on one income. The difference is I don't have two Ferraris parked out in the driveway. I'm not living in a 12-bedroom mansion, okay? And I don't drive have a dripping in diamonds. Us Americans do not know what it means to be poor. A poor person in America is a person who has a television set in every bedroom, all right, a large screen TV in the living room, and every game system that's ever been invented. That's a poor person in America.
Yeah, I got to agree with you there.
Okay. You do not need two incomes. If you added up the amount of money it cost you in babysitting, in child care, what, you know, wherever you may be, whatever you may be doing, okay, you add up all that extra cost and you put that up against what your second income is, you're going to wake up and realize, damn, I'm working for $2 an hour and somebody else is raising my kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, makes no sense. You don't need that expensive car. You don't need to buy a new car every year. Okay? You don't even need two cars. But then again, I say have two cars. You need, the stay-at-home parent does need a vehicle to, in case there is an emergency, to get the kids from school, you know, to go out and do the errands during the day while the other person is working, you know, to do the grocery shopping, so on and so forth. So two cars is a necessity, but they don't have to be two brand spanking new cars. My car
so
is
American
paid for in cash.
So you're saying Americans
outright.
Yeah. So you're saying Americans don't live within their means. That we're a credit society.
Absolutely. And they're brainwashed, saying that they have to have all these other products.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, a new computer just came out. I got to trash my old one. What are you nuts? I still got my same computer I bought in 1980 and still works.
How'd you manage that?
It tells me, dude. They all work. You know,
how can that be? Because the programs take up so much memory.
But even the older systems, okay, you can convert. See, my old systems were Mac. They don't use that much memory.
Oh,
SD.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, my 1995 PC, my Windows first was 1995, the year it came out, and that's when I bought my first PC and got off of Mac. Okay? That was all upgradable. I still have my very first system. Matter of fact, my kid uses it. Yeah. And I've upgraded it. I've changed out the motherboard so I can accommodate a larger processor in it, but it still has everything that computer came with. And it's still running like a dream today. Matter of fact, half the time it runs better than my new computer.
No kidding.
Yeah. Well, think of the old cars. The old cars ran better. You got better gas mileage on a carburetor. I can take a big V8 carburetor car, not worrying about all this electronic, all the emission, all the other BS they put into it, and it gets almost the same amount of mileage as the top-rated high fuel economy mileage of today.
Yeah.
Where it's all electronic and bullshit, and, you know, hell, back then, a new car cost you a couple thousand dollars.
Well, I got a 68 Buick, and that thing sucks up the fuel.
Oh, dude, you just got to get some tweaks, man. There's actual kits you can buy that you can attach to your carburetor and all. And different things you can do for your air intakes and stuff, and you can double that mileage and no problem. I loved my Buick. I had a Buick Electra. Had a big 225, I think that's what it was called, the 420, 445, 420.
Yeah.
One of the big, huge bastards. And that car would fly. And a tweak here, a tweak there. I forgot what else I did. And one buddy was a mechanic when I first was growing up. And, he tooled around with it. And, dude, I was getting, like, 25, 26 miles a gallon with that sucker. And
not
that
bad.
Thing cruises at 160 miles an hour.
Wow.
Yeah.
I got to rebuild the carburetor on it.
Oh, yeah.
That's out of my comfort zone.
Carburetor kits are easy. Believe it or not, if you can do a jigsaw puzzle, you can do that. You go buy the kit for $15-$20. All the parts are right there in front of you. You take the four bolts off, lift the carburetor up, and you look at the carburetor. Say, okay, there's the parts on the table. There's what the carburetor looks. Screwdriver, you can do the whole thing in a half hour.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah, real easy. Super easy. There's nothing to it. There's literally, it's not like the new cars. I mean, you know, if you can change a spark plug in a new car today, you can rebuild an entire motor of a carburetor motor.
Yeah, because I used to do that. I used to change the spark plugs, the Everything. Used to do the whole tune-up on my old Toyota, but now I don't even try it because everything's so electronic.
Exactly. Well, back in the day, if you can do points and condensers.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about part of your tune-up. Before the electronics. If you can do that, you can do anything to an old car.
Hmm.
So that was the hardest thing about doing an old engine is the points, to adjust the points just right, to time those points out and set the timing. You can do that? Psh, dude, there ain't nothing you can't do on a motor. Now, a new car, I wouldn't even change the damn spark plugs in it.
Nah. I didn't realize you knew your way around a car so good.
Oh, yeah. Most of my life growing up was towing and recovery.
Oh, yeah? You're a repo guy?
Yeah, that's all I said. I worked for the highway authority in New Jersey. Out there on the Garden State Parkway.
Interesting.
Did that for 8 years.
No kidding.
Yeah, I loved that job. So, yeah, the motors, I know.
We may have to talk.
Oh, yeah. It's easy stuff. Good stuff.
Well, all right,
but
Doc.
Anyway, well, I'm not going to have to see you now for a whole nother week.
No.
Dangy, fangy. Oh, well. Why don't you take care of yourself? Be good. Did you get a chance to talk to Vito at all or talk over about doing that roundtable event?
We discussed it briefly, but we didn't come to any conclusions yet.
Okay. So you haven't shot down the idea yet either?
No, not at all. I'll talk to you more about that later.
Well, you got my number. I'm always here. Give me a call anytime, bud.
All right, we'll do a good show, and I'll talk to you before. I'll talk to you during the week.
All right, then.
All right, have a good one.
Enjoy it. God bless, and talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks a lot, Doc. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.